Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. In this month's show, a trip to the Science Museum to find out about the science of sight. And New York, as you may not have seen it before, courtesy of a group of artists known as the Ashcan School. But we start with our major new exhibition, Jan Gossaert's Renaissance. Gossaert was one of the most celebrated artists of the first three decades of the 16th century. Active in the Low Countries, the lands now covered by Belgium and the Netherlands, Gossaert was admired as much for his dazzling illusionism as for his sensuous depiction of flesh. But today he's not an artist many of us have heard of, and the coming exhibition is the first dedicated to him in over 40 years. Sue Jones is the author of a new National Gallery book entitled Van Eyck to Gossaert, Towards a Northern Renaissance. Leah Caribbean met up with her to find out what this re-evaluation of a forgotten master has in store.
Sue, we're here in the main galleries in advance of Jan Gossaert's Renaissance, opening to the public in front of a picture that's part of the permanent collection and I'm sure will be one of the stars of the show. It's a truly magnificent depiction of the Adoration of the Kings that Gossaert painted in about 1510 to 15. And I wondered if you could begin by taking us through it and telling us a little bit about the man himself.
The subject is the Adoration of the Kings, and the kings have arrived in Bethlehem having followed a star from the east, and they're here with their gifts of gold, myrrh and frankincense, presenting them to the Christ child, who's seated on his mother's lap in the centre of the composition. And Gossaert has taken advantage of the large-scale format of the painting and the fact that he knew it would be fairly accessible and a fairly large number of people would see it to display a wide range of his artistic skills and his artistic knowledge, most obviously perhaps in the fact that the painting has a very deep space and that he's been able to arrange such a large number of figures and animals and angels within that space using a variety of different viewpoints. But also he's been able to show his ability to depict a very wide range of different textures and materials. So, for example, you can see the silk velvet of the mantle of the eldest king, the cloth of gold textiles, the hair of the dog's coats, the chipped flagstones in the foreground, and the metalwork objects. All these things have been calculated to impress the observer with Gossaert's skill in painting.
I mean, they certainly do. I mean, he paints with the most astonishing detail, but also sort of, I don't know, observational clarity. I mean, you feel as if you could reach out and touch all these fabrics.
Gossaert was actually very well known for his ability to depict fabrics. And in this painting, he's in a number of areas. There are passages of virtuoso detailing, but also you can see it in more naturalistic details, such as the hairy wart on the side of the face of the eldest king, and which has a whole variety of hairs of different lengths and colours coming out of it.
That's wonderful, but I mean, it's all his imagination, isn't it? I mean, he's imagined this in a sort of pungently, sort of real way, somehow.
It's a highly artificial painting, I would say. I mean, obviously, he has retained some passages of observation, things he's observed from reality, but it's obviously a very carefully calculated and composed painting.
Now, Sue, he's really working in his native painting tradition here, isn't he, Gossaert? I mean, that's a sort of style of painting that goes all the way back to masters like Jan van Eyck. But one of the fascinating things that the show highlights, I think, people will find, is that there was an entirely different side to Gossaert's work. And while its frame is being attended to before the show opens, there's a wonderful example that's being looked after up in conservation, and I'd really love to hear your thoughts on it. Would you like to come with me?
Of course.
So we're now up in the conservation department in front of Gossaert's Adam and Eve, a work of about 1520 that's on loan to the gallery from the Royal Collection. And this really couldn't be more different from the Adoration. I mean, the figures are big, they're nude, and they're muscly. What's going on?
Well, there's quite a lot going on, actually. Gossaert was very interested in the nude figure, and he had the opportunity to study it in a variety of ways over his career. He's very well known for being the first Netherlandish painter to introduce into the Netherlands the Italian manner of depicting nudes in historical and mythological subjects. And in 1508-9, he went to Rome as part of an embassy with his patron, Philip of Burgundy, and was the first Netherlandish painter, or the first recorded, to study and make drawings of nudes from ancient Roman statues.
But, I mean, these figures aren't at all like antique or Italian Renaissance nudes, are they? They seem to be very much more earthy. They seem to have all these sort of interesting physical details. I mean, just look at the size of their feet, for instance.
Yes, well, what Gossard did really was to transform the ancient nude figure in order to make it interesting for himself and his patrons. So here you have a balance of a figure that is idealistic and naturalistic, and also has in the hair, for example, and in parts of, certainly in Eve's hair, which is twisting and winding through space, has a quite pronounced decorative quality as well.
And do you think that this, the fact that he doesn't paint like an Italian, and his ideal of beauty, say, for example, in Eve's face, is quite particular. It's not necessarily a sort of standard ideal of beauty that we've come to accept from the Italian Renaissance onward. Do you think this is why Gossard is an artist that has perhaps been overlooked in the past?
There's probably something to that. I mean, I think that the fact that he is a relatively obscure artist now, when he was so famous in his own time, must have something to do with the fact that from the late 16th century onwards, Italian Renaissance art dominated European art production. It may also have something to do with the fact that Gossard is so difficult to categorise as an artist himself. He's an artist who evolved a very unique personal style. He was very interested in a whole variety of things, in architectural ornamentation, in lettering, in sculpture, in printmaking. He was also, we should mention, one of the great portrait painters of the period, and the exhibition will have a whole room of his portraits. He was a brilliant technician, as we discussed earlier. So he was very versatile and also rather idiosyncratic. There's no one else in this period quite like him.
Thanks to Sue Jones. Jan Gossard's Renaissance opens on the 23rd of February. Tickets are available from the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. And if you're visiting, don't forget the audio guide. It's written by our own Leah Caribbean and features interviews with the curators. In March, another exhibition opens at the gallery. It's a small show of just 12 paintings, never seen before in the UK. Called An American Experiment, George Bellows and the Ashcan School, it examines an art movement that centred on New York in the early 20th century. This was a period of rapid urban development, and Bellows and the other Ashcan painters revelled in exploring the harsher aspects of the changing city to create a uniquely American style of painting. The exhibition has been made possible by a partnership with the Terra Foundation for American Art, a relationship that will introduce many US masterpieces to UK audiences through a series of shows over coming years. Catherine Bourguignon is Associate Curator of the Terra Foundation and one of the organisers of An American Experiment. She took us on a journey through some of the works on display.
Excavation at night invites us into a very dark, strange environment. In fact, it takes the viewer a while to figure out even what we're looking at. We see contrast between dark black color and bright hints of light. And Bellows is actually showing us the excavation site for Penn Station in the heart of Manhattan. If we look very carefully, we can start to make sense of this strange painting. We can see a fire in the foreground with a few workmen gathered around it. We can see bright cliffs in the background. This is actually the sides of the gaping hole that they've been digging, and they're illuminated by these artificial arc lights. And then in the very background, almost as a flat backdrop, are these tenement buildings highlighted by street lights, a not very welcoming scene of Manhattan at night. George Bellows was part of what became later known as the Ashcan School. It is not a compliment. That's a term that a critic used to describe their works. Because these artists, a group of about 10 painters in New York City in the early 20th century, were interested in scenes of urban life. They often used dark colors in their painting, especially a lot of black. And they were interested in showing scenes of urban life that's not glittery and glamorous, but rather the rougher side, the lower classes, the working classes. And so the Ashcan School was just a group of artists who shared that desire to show us the truth about American urban life at that time. George Bellows painted North River in February 1908, and it was one of a series of pictures that he produced from the same site, from Riverside Park, looking out at the Hudson River, which was known as the North River right in this side because it runs along Manhattan, and looking out towards New Jersey. What we're seeing is looking down from a slight vantage point at a steamship and also a steam train. We can only notice the train because of the billowing smoke that goes off to the right, and then the river beyond and the cliffs far in the background. The scene is covered in snow, and the only people present are very small figures located right at the water's edge. Bellows is not trying to show us the hustle-bustle activity of an active port. Instead, he's showing us this sort of edge of the urban environment, as if he's turned his back for a moment on the busy city life, looking out towards the river and with very little sign of human presence. It's very exciting to bring George Bellows and some of his Ashcan painters to the National Gallery. It's an effort to bring American art into this very important international gallery, but it's also a way to show us that these early 20th century American artists, who aren't very well known in Great Britain, were looking to the masters. Bellows was definitely influenced by Manet, by Velázquez, by Frans Hals, and while these are landscape scenes and we mostly think of those artists associated with figurative works, we can look just at the brushstrokes and at the way paint is applied, at the use of black, I think, at the flattening of the compositions. And this is what Bellows and his contemporaries are learning from the masters. But the subjects that they're choosing and the way that they're painting them is showing us that they're really looking at America in the 20th century, and especially urban America, painting New York City as they could see it. And that's really the first time that we see anyone painting the city in quite this way.
Thanks to Catherine Bourguignon. If you'd like to see the paintings for yourself, an American experiment opens on the 3rd of March in Room 1. Admission is free. Colour is one of the most intense and immediate pleasures of art. Yet the way in which our brains have come to understand colour is anything but immediate. Neuroscientist Dr. Bo Lotto argues that our brains evolved over time to see what was most useful to our survival, and that our perception of colour is a case in point. He's giving a talk at the National Gallery this month, and by way of a taster, I went to meet him at the Science Museum, where he's building a living lab to explain his ideas. I began by asking why we see colour the way that we do.
No one really understands why and how we see colour. And the reason why we study it is because, as I say, it is the simplest thing that the brain does. Even jellyfish are able to see the difference in intensity of something. And what's phenomenal about colour vision is that most animals have it in one form or another. So it's something we share with lots and lots of other critters. And within color vision contains the fundamental problem that vision evolved to solve, which is to resolve ambiguity. The light that falls onto the eye is infinitely meaningless because it could mean anything. And the brain evolved to somehow take that information and make something useful out of it, to see it in a way that's useful to see. And so by studying color vision, we're aiming to understand how the brain literally makes sense of the world and itself.
So it sounds like colour vision is evolutionary in that it's the result of an evolutionary process, but also that effectively somehow by seeing things and learning to interpret those things in a certain way, we're learning to see?
We're always learning to see. The brain evolved to adapt. So again, the information, the light that falls into the eye, because it's ambiguous, the brain can't just use that information to see. It has to use something else, and that something else that it uses is its history. Its history of interacting with the world, the objects in the world. And again, color vision is a wonderful, beautiful way of literally perceiving that history. So when we look out into the world, when we see colors, we're not necessarily seeing what's there, we're seeing historically what was useful to see. So we're seeing the consequence of evolution, of development, of learning.
One of the things that we really appreciate about art is the way that artists use colour. How do you, as someone who understands a bit about why we perceive colour the way we do, what do you see in artworks? How does that able you to appreciate what's going on.
Thinking about the perceptual relationships between colours, of course, began with art. Artists have been playing with that for centuries. Delacroix is a beautiful... There are hundreds of examples, but Delacroix in particular, where he takes an object that's red, surrounds it by green, because in doing so, it makes that red appear far more vibrant, and vice versa. The green also appears far more saturated, far more colorful when there's red embedded within it. So artists, of course, have been looking at these perceptual relationships for a long time. And one of the first people to sort of quantify these relationships was, in fact, a chemist. And so he was hired by the King of France to figure out what was wrong with the tapestries that people were ordering. So they would go into the shop, so to speak, and pick out their threads. The threads would get woven together. And the colors that they saw, as a consequence, were not the same as the ones they had originally selected. So they figured the problem must be in the dyes. So they hired a chemist. Turns out, after 30 years, figured out the problem wasn't in the dyes, it was in the brain. And it's because colors, when set next to each other, affect your perception of them. And again, what that's demonstrating is the effect of context. But again, what artists hadn't been doing is thinking about why these relationships exist. Why does one color affect the perception of another? Often what happens then is a neuroscientist comes in and he or she will say, well, it's because the brain is wired this way. It's wired, the eyes are wired in a particular way that you have interactions between brain cells that cause one brain cell to be affected by another depending on what you're looking at. But even there, that doesn't answer the question. It just provides a mechanistic foundation for why that happens. What we're doing, and what I'll be talking about in my presentation, is why that happens. And in answering that question, we can understand more deeply about perception generally and how the brain works.
Beau Lotto, who'll be giving a free lecture at the National Gallery on Friday the 18th of February at 6:30 p.m. The gallery is open late on Friday nights, until 9 p.m, so after Beau's talk there'll still be time to take a look at the paintings, get a drink at the bar, or grab a bite to eat. For details of the lecture or any of the other pictures, exhibitions or events I've mentioned, see our website, www.nationalgallery.org.uk. That's it for this episode. Until next month, goodbye.